AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago, Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis says that there has only been one unconfirmed death in Florida from Hurricane Idalia, quite different from a year ago.
Bad news type calls that we were so accustomed to during Ian, you know, those really were not happening on this storm, certainly not to that level.
CBS's Omar Villafranca in Crystal River, Florida.
As the water level goes down, we're still seeing rescue vehicles speeding around, taking people to higher ground. There are shelters set up for people who don't have a place to stay, but residents tell me it's going to take months to clean up all this mess.
Idalia is now a tropical storm in southern South Carolina. CBS's Manuel Bojorquez in Savannah says the danger there is not over.
In these low-lying areas of Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, what you have going into tonight is the high tide is expected to happen later, but you also have rain from the storm still potentially coming downstream from areas where it is still pouring. So that confluence of water, that's a concern. It could still leave many communities waterlogged.
There are at least 430,000 customers in five southern states without power, according to PowerOutage.us. North Korea stages a tactical nuclear strike drill. More from reporter Alex Jensen in Seoul.
Following two ballistic missile launches late Wednesday here, North Korea clarified they were part of exercises responding to this month's drills involving the U.S. and South Korea. In particular, the North appears to have been upset by the presence of American B-1B bombers over and around the Korean Peninsula Wednesday.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell briefly froze, not answering a question from a reporter at an event in Kentucky today. He had a similar episode weeks ago in Washington. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are sending him well wishes, including Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont.
I hope he makes a full recovery and does what he thinks is best for the people of Kentucky and for himself.
McConnell's office says the senator was feeling momentarily lightheaded and would see a doctor. Outraged parents railed at Tennessee legislators after the Republican-led House refused to take up gun control measures and lawmakers clashed. CBS's Allison Keyes reports.
We did surveys of AAA Northeast members.
They saw the bodies.
Sarah Shoup Newman is a parent from the Covenant School, where three children and three adults were killed in a mass shooting. Democrat Justin Jones was silenced after twice speaking out for gun control.
What is one little Glock against an AR-15?
Representative Jones, that's not the bill that's before you, sir.
The gallery was cleared for speaking out during the proceedings. During the session called to address public safety, just four bills were passed.
This is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit. Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. The wheels on the bus could come to a stop if Milwaukee County transit drivers don't have their concerns addressed.
A recent shooting on a Milwaukee County bus has prompted union members to consider their options for addressing safety concerns. The union leader says they've been advocating for improved safety measures but have faced resistance. One proposed solution is to have undercover sheriffs patrolling the bus routes. The union is contemplating a safety-related work stoppage to demonstrate the seriousness of their concerns and demand meaningful action from the authorities. Peach Waba, Civic Media News.
The Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over campaign is going on now through September 4th across the state. Law enforcement is stepping up patrols in greater numbers for longer hours. Every 2 hours in Wisconsin, impaired driving kills or injures someone. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Hi, this is Lindsay Kynard at 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK The Shaw. Here are upcoming events happening in the area.
On Wednesday the 30th, take in musical selections during lunch on the Waukesha Riverwalk. Grab a bite to eat from one of the local food trucks, enjoy a meal at one of the downtown restaurants, or bring a lunch to enjoy Riverside from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. On Thursday the 31st, the Pewaukee Lake Waterski Show features water skiing acts along with fun and energetic music. The event starts at 6:15, goes till 7:30 right on the lakefront. On Friday, enjoy live music on various stages throughout downtown Waukesha with Waukesha's Friday Night Live, 6:30 till 9 p.m. And from 10 till 5 on Saturday, spend the day at the Third Ward Art Festival in Milwaukee. Free and open to the public, the 11th annual Art Fest will feature work of 150 artists from around the country.
If you have an event you'd like us to share, let me know. Email me, Lindsay Kiner, at info@civicmedia.us.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Cities to cut local air pollution and emissions, and officials say they're cheaper to operate. And finally, in Ecuador, in a historic national referendum, Ecuadorians voted overwhelmingly to ban oil drilling in Yasuni National Park in the Amazon rainforest, one of the most diverse biospheres in the world. It's hailed as a historic example of climate democracy, and it was also a victory for indigenous peoples and conservationists.
I will share that hailing. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as the school year ramps up for students, you got these big moneyed front groups there. Well, they're ramping up big on their attacks on public education. And look, this isn't new. There have always been ideologues and grifters biting at the ankles of our education system, looking for their narrow self-interest. But now seems a little different. Seems a little more well-funded, a little more well-coordinated, a lot angrier, a lot more hateful, and way more political. Remember the good old days when good old boy Rick Perry had his oops moment? Couldn't remember the three agencies of government he wanted to destroy back at 11? Education was one that he remembered. And here to talk about this ongoing assault on our children and the future for our children, I've asked Randy Weingarten to come talk with us. Randy is the president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course, Rick. It's really great to be with you, and happy Labor Day and happy new school year.
So as this school year ramps up, these attacks appear to be ramping up, well, a lot more than I think we've seen in past years.
Well, actually, in the last 2 years, there's been a lot of attacks by the extremist groups. I mean, Mehdi Hassan just did a fantastic deep dive into what has happened, which is that during COVID, you know, a lot of people were scared. There's a lot of deaths. There are a lot of kids that were orphaned. And there were a lot of schools closed by starting with Republican governors for the whole balance of the year in 2020, 2021. And then they made a decision, for reasons I still don't know, that they were just going to open schools without creating any kind of safety issues, instead of working with us, who were always viewed that, you know, schools needed to be open for kids, but they needed to be safe for kids and adults. And we were trying to do that from April 2020. And from that point on, what you've seen is this relentless assault on schools, on teachers, on public health, on pretending that COVID didn't exist, and on then actually talking about the ramifications of what has happened because of COVID. Not one new idea about what to do about it, but what they're trying to do, and I'm going through this explanation very intentionally, is they just want to create distrust. And they tell us this.
Yes.
They basically say they're trying to do whatever they can to create distrust, because if they do that, they think they're going to get to destroy public education and create universal vouchers. And that's what they're trying to do. So they throw whatever spaghetti on the wall they can throw. They don't have any ideas for how to address kids' loneliness, how to address learning loss, how to address what has happened as a result of COVID. And instead, they just smear and smear and smear. So that's what they're doing again this year. And frankly, people are starting to find out, because the Washington Post this week connected the dots between the funders and the theocrats, like, you know, Christopher Rufo, who says you've got to create universal public school distrust to get universal vouchers, the funders like Betsy DeVos, and then now this lawyer by the name of Farris, who has basically told his funders that the way in which you get to universal vouchers is just take every case in the book, throw at them the culture wars, divide, divide, divide. And I guess what I would say is this: we see all of that. And what we have to do, and I have become single-minded about this, public schools are the future of our kids. Public schools are the future of democracy. And our union and our members and teachers across America right now are simply trying to address the needs of kids so that kids can recover and thrive. So they ban books, we give books out. They stop, we call them out when they say we can't teach honest history, and we defend people who do. But most importantly, we address loneliness, we address learning loss, we address literacy, and we really try to help our teachers and paraprofessionals help all kids succeed. That's what we're trying to do.
No, and I'm 100% on board with that, but I look at what the other side's been doing, and for decades, as was reported here, and look, we've been following this for years as well. The moneyed interests have been trying to destroy public education for a bunch of reasons.
Right.
One, control. Two, to get into the coffers of Education Incorporated. And three, the religious component that came out in this Post article that you talked about, because I've been talking about the Quiverful movement for at least a decade now, and what their dream is to be able to put a backpack of money on every kid so that they can have as many children as they want and have Education Incorporated pay them to homeschool. That's the end goal for a lot of these folks, is to get to that point to where they're taking money out of the system.
Look, you're absolutely right, and sorry, I'm in an airport talking to you right now. You're absolutely right. The end goal is they don't want to strengthen public schools. They want to destroy them. And for whatever reasons they're trying to destroy them, whether it is because of supremacy or whether it is because, of segregation, like we saw right after Brown versus Board of Education, or whether it is because they don't want to spend the money on all kids, or, whether it is this Christian nationalism, whatever it is, their tactics are the same. Smear, 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 create fear, undermine, attack, attack. They don't even have one idea for how many of them have talked about, learning loss, mental health. And then they cut money from the budget that is supposed to be used for mental health. Then Moms for Liberty says, oh no, we're not gonna do any social emotional learning in schools. So this is not about kids. This is about just destroying public education and the opportunity that it comes with. And I'm glad the Washington Post revealed this guy Farris. I'm glad that people publicly, they're saying the quiet part out loud now. Jonah Edelman and I, talked about this in an op-ed last year. We don't always get along on everything, but we said vouchers and this a movement to privatize is fundamentally a movement to destroy public education and the opportunity that means for all kids. Let me say one more thing. Are our schools perfect? No, they're not perfect. Do we need to do a lot more? Yes. But we need to do, we know what works and we know what we need to do. And that's why our campaign this whole year is Real Solutions for Kids and Communities.
Right.
And I love the fact that Nikki Haley is talking about some of the same issues that I'm talking about. Nobody calls her an extremist. So let's actually, Republicans and Democrats alike, let's focus on literacy. Let's focus on career pathways for kids. Let's get and make sure that school is joyful and fun. And let's do the social emotional things we need to do to help create connection for kids and to recreate community.
No, absolutely. And as a parent, you know, I want the public education system to be as strong as it possibly can to give my kids and others the best opportunities. And I think all parents want that. At least they should. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Randy Weingarten. She's the president of the American Federation of Teachers. You can check out their website, aft.org. The Hill had a story the other day I wanted to get your thought on. They were talking about the Republicans wanting to do away with the Department of Education, which, again, I go back to Rick Perry in 2011. One of the three agencies he remembered he wanted to destroy was obviously education. They asked the question, what would it look like if we destroyed the Department of Education? What would it look like if we allowed education to be privatized, profitized, or voucherized? What would that look like? What would the future for our kids look like, do you think?
It would mean that we would have the haves and the have-nots. That's what it would mean. So if you're rich and wealthy and you had a way of, you know, paying a lot of money to get your kids a good education, you'd be fine. And everybody else would not. Public education is the route for the middle class to have opportunity. Just like the labor movement is the route for the middle class to have opportunity. Public education was the route for people who are poor or people who are vulnerable to have opportunity. And frankly, that 1% still has more wealth than the 90% of America. And so it is one more stratification of America. One of the things that America has done that almost no other country did, which was create a public education system for all kids and create opportunity. What this would be is just take the ladder of opportunity, just pull it out for the next generation. I think we've done enough negative things for the next generation. Let's not take opportunity away from them.
I'm right there with you. I got to get your thoughts on the most recent decisions coming out of the Biden administration. I mean, I got to tell you, I don't want you to decide one way or another here, but I think Biden's been killing it policy-wise on labor rights. Last Friday, you had the CMEX decision coming out of the NLRB. On Monday, you had the task force saying that we want to encourage more unions. Today, you got the threshold for wages and salaried employees. I lately just killing it, in my opinion.
Look, I think what you have, and you and I have had this conversation. No one is perfect. No president is perfect. No vice president is perfect. No union president is perfect. No media personality is perfect. But if you look at what, not even you, Rick, if you look at what Joe Biden has done, it's been incredible. And this year is a year where he has said he's going to try to implement for the good of working people, all of the legislative accomplishments, as well as what, you know, that were passed last year and 2 years ago, but also make the government work for regular folks. So look at the set of drugs selected for Medicare price negotiation. You know, these drugs support millions of people. And what happens if they cost a whole lot less? You know who's going to lose out? Big pharma. You know who's going to win? Our seniors. And by doing that with the price pressure, it's going to put price pressure on to reduce prices on all these drugs for everyone else. That case, the Teamsters case, yeah. I mean, there should be some degree of pain point if a corporation has done anti-union animus, and there should be some way of incentivizing good behavior to let people have real decision-making authority about whether they want a union. But also look at the industrial policy. Look at what's happened. We have more opportunity to have good jobs in the private sector, a re-industrialization of America, a manufacturing resonance, renaissance, a made in America. And then what we're trying to do in terms of high schools is actually align so that kids in high school can make choices, go to college, get a job, have a good job, have credentials to that. So what Joe Biden is doing is he first, during COVID, he tried to turn things around. He helped reopen schools safely. He got people a lot of shots. He got us out of the worst aspects of COVID. And now he is bringing the economy back in a way that really emphasizes and prioritizes working people and using government to do that. I think it's terrific. It's really terrific.
No, we're in an exciting moment because we're returning to the values that I talk about in my grandparents' generation. You know, strong public education, strong investment in that education, and also jobs that you can support a family on, and domestic production for domestic consumption. All these great themes. We've got a guy who's doing, he's not saying it, he's actually doing it. So the question that I have for you on this is, how do we pick this up and move it forward? Because I don't think the administration is doing enough to tout what they're doing.
Well, I think that we're living in a period of time of great division and where people are in their tribes. And so it is really a matter of neighbors talking to neighbors about this. It's not just on the administration to tout all of this. It's all of us to actually talk about what the real impact is of what the president has done. And to talk about it in a way that's positive and proactive, because A, he's trying, and B, he's getting results. So it's on all of us to help make the case clear about what he's done.
Last question I've got for you. You know, as I said in the beginning of this, we're ramping up the new school year. I see these attacks on public education happening. I have parents in my neighborhood saying, hey, what do we do to push back on these insane groups who are infiltrating our school boards and all of this? What's the advice for parents in this moment? Because, you know, look, most parents, the vast majority of parents want their local school to be a local public school with the best resources possible and the best teachers at the front of it. What's the word for parents?
Just get involved in any way you can possibly get involved. And if you're not a parent, get involved. When all of a sudden at a school board meeting, there's more people who say, first, let's have a sane debate. Let's not scream at each other. And secondly, let's actually honor the work that's getting done in schools. And if we have differences, let's problem solve the differences. When that starts happening at a school board meeting, the extremists leave. They are, and look, there are some parents who have legitimate issues about what's going on in schools, and we want to hear them. I thought that Terry McAuliffe was wrong when in that debate he said, you know, he seemed to dismiss parent wishes. We need to work with parents. We need to be with parents, and parents and teachers together are an amazing combination. The extremists want to divide. We want to bring people together, even if we don't agree on everything. So just get involved a little bit. Anything. Vote in school board elections. If there's a spaghetti dinner or a movie night, go and support the school. If there's like a bouncy house festival before a football game, go be with the school. We're giving out a boatload of books. We've done 9 million books already around the country. We're going to give out another million this year. Come to one of these festivals where we give out books to kids and to families, help, volunteer. But most importantly, we need to have the beloved community support our public schools, and that then supports our kids and our democracy.
There you go, Randy. I appreciate the time. Safe travels. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
Thank you, Rick. Take care.
Good stuff. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I tell you, I like Randy Weingarten. And to be honest with you, we need champions like that to defend our public education system. Once they take that away, she's right. Understand what the Republican Party has been saying for the last 20 years. They want to destroy public education. They want to privatize it. Now, we used to go, well, it's because they believe in the free market. It used to be this ideological discussion about competition. It used to be about, best outcomes. And, they played on the idea that all of us parents, we want our kids to have the best opportunities. That's just simple reality. Every parent wants their kids to have the best education possible. They prey on that. What we know, the gimmicks that they have brought forth, they don't do any better, and in most cases do worse, except for the few. And the voucher programs, the eye-opener in all of that came for me, well over 10 years ago, when in my state of Pennsylvania, we had a state senator who claimed he wrote a voucher bill. He didn't write it. It was given to him. It was a model. I think it was an ALEC model legislation. Because he clearly didn't understand what was in his bill. Because I asked him, I said, look, if I get this golden ticket, if I get this voucher for my kid, because I do, I want my kids to get the best opportunities possible. I want them to have the same opportunities Obama's kids had or Biden's kids or Trump's kids had. The wealth class, the upper crust, they always get the best education for their kids. I asked, I said, if I get one of these golden tickets, can I send my kid to this elite school in Philadelphia? And I know how much it costs to go to that school. Kindergarten's like 40 grand a year. First grade's like 50. And he said, absolutely. You get the golden ticket. You can send the kid anywhere and they're going to take it. They're going to take your child and they're going to get the best education. Now, that's preying on my belief that, hey, I'm going to get my kid an elite education in a top private school in this country. What parent wouldn't jump at that chance? But when you drill down into his legislation, when you drill down into the bill, what you found is all you really got was what your school district was allocating per child. So if your school district is in one of the poorer areas of Pennsylvania where they may spend $8,000 or $9,000 per child, that's all you get. Now that's short of the $40,000 for kindergarten or $50,000 for first grade. So where does that other money come from? Well, it comes from you. You got to make it up. And most parents don't have that ability. Or if you're from one of the more affluent school districts that may pay upwards of $20,000 per student, even still, you're not at 40, you're not at 50. So that sleight of hand that they throw out, that you're going to get to go to these elite schools, is not true. And then I asked, I said, well, if I can't afford to send my kids to these elite schools, do the people whose kids go there get this money? And he said, oh, no, we would never do that. Only his bill actually did do that. And what we've found on these voucher fronts in many cases is the people who are already sending their kids to these schools are just getting a windfall. So we're literally making the wealthier wealthier at the expense of poor school districts, and making our public education system worse off because of less funding. So the question becomes, when do we say enough, and when do we fight back? When do we stand up? You may remember 2018 when the teachers in West Virginia went on strike, and there was a wave across this country of educators saying, you know what? We demand better wages, conditions. We demand better opportunities for our kids, conditions. Because our working conditions are our kids' learning conditions. When do we say enough? And when do we start taking to the streets on the right things? I know my Moms from Misery groups are out there trying to figure out how to destroy their local public schools. But how do we make them better? See, that's the conversation you don't get out of them. Because they've got an ideological agenda. And it's not your local school. Gonna take a quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Revenue Tax Act, more popularly known as the Wealth Tax. The act reformed the federal income tax to raise rates on the wealthiest in the nation. Those making over $5 million a year could pay taxes up to 75%. In a speech to Congress that summer, Roosevelt had explained his thoughts on wealth and taxes. The president said, quote, "Wealth in the modern world does not come merely from individual effort. It results from a combination of individual effort and of the manifold uses to which the community puts that effort. The individual does not create the product of his industry with his own hands. He utilizes the many processes and forces of mass production to meet the demands of a national and international market. Therefore, in spite of the great importance in our national life of the efforts and ingenuity of unusual individuals, the people in the mass have inevitably helped to make large fortunes possible. Without mass cooperation, FDR said, great accumulation of wealth would be impossible save by unhealthy speculation." The president went on, "As Andrew Carnegie put it, where wealth accumulates honorably, the people are always silent partners. Whether it be wealth achieved through the cooperation of the entire community or riches gained by speculation, in either case, the ownership of such wealth or riches represents a great public interest and a great ability to pay." Although FDR tried to win over the nation's wealthy by quoting industrialist Andrew Carnegie, he did not gain their support. Not surprisingly, many of the nation's wealthy lobbied for and used tax loopholes to evade paying the new tax rates. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Peggy Lee struck a mournful chord with her hit song, "Is That All There Is?" It was about the vapidity of life, and I found myself subconsciously singing along last week as I pondered the GOP presidential debate. Of course, these made-for-TV spectacles are more akin to mud wrestling than actual policy debates. Still, I dared hope for some tiny element of civic seriousness. After all, the 8 aspirants were auditioning to be, oh say can you see, the next president of the United States. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, for example, stands out as a textbook example of the vapidity of modern American politics. A rampaging ego with no core democratic principles, no authentic persona, no speaking from the heart, and no possibility of being elected, except that special interest powers have pumped him up with a couple $100 million to be their boy. Indeed, a strategy memo from DeSantis' own funders and consultants surfaced publicly just before last week's debate, confirming his vacuity as a candidate and a person. The detailed memo instructed him to avoid talking about policy solutions, to sledgehammer an opponent, to appear both for and against Trump, and maybe to show a little human emotion by talking about his kids. In short, he needs advisors to tell him how to be himself. DeSantis is hardly the first Who Am I candidate for the White House. Hillary Clinton's managers reintroduced her as the new real Hillary every couple of months in 2016, and Rick Perry's handlers tried to make him look smart by wearing horn-rimmed glasses. This is Jim Hightower saying this lack of authenticity is now the norm, for it allows big money to shape candidates in its image. And that's why today's public policies are overwhelmingly based on what money wants, not on public need and honest principle.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about, education is something that, you know, every parent is going to have to fight for. You know, and I love this frame that's been thrown out at us. You know, my teacher's okay, but it's all those other ones that are bad. And that's the frustration because, you know, you talk to even the crazy ones, even the maniacs for misery groups who, you know, public education is a disaster. But my local teacher, she's okay. And it's this, the way they project that it's the system that's broken. And that gives them cover to go after and make our kids' learning conditions worse. And as I talked about with Randy Weingarten a minute ago, the reality is they want to privatize, profitize, and destroy public education. They want it in the hands of the profiteers, and which is why it's fabulous to see when teachers organize and stand up and fight back. That's why I've asked Yanni Govoloff to come talk with us. He is a filmmaker. They got a new film out. It's called When We Fight. It's about the 2019 Los Angeles teachers strike, one of the largest in history, but actually fought and won better conditions for not just for teachers, but for students. Yanni, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
So what made you get involved in this? I mean, you know, we've been watching this war on education happen for some time. It's not new, but, you know, finally teachers had enough of it and began to fight back. So why'd you pick this particular fight?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. This war has been going on for so long. And you know, I'm a filmmaker, and this war has been going on, obviously, in schools and in legislatures, but also in film. I mean, there was, you know, films like Waiting for Superman, you know, trumpeting the power of charter schools and the need within the public discourse to actually say, no, what we need is fully funded public schools. And myself and the co-filmmaker, my partner in this film, Yael Bridge, she and I were talking, both of us have multiple teachers in our families and we've seen how hard they work and really believe, like Randy Weingarten was saying earlier, public education is one of the bedrocks of democracy in this country, period. I mean, without public education, we just don't have that. And we were seeing these historic education strikes and revolts in West Virginia, in Arizona, and Oklahoma, people fighting to, in a lot of these states, for example, fighting to raise taxes on oil to fund education, places where people had too many kids in a classroom, textbooks falling apart. And, you know, we missed it. As filmmakers, we missed it. Yael and I didn't get to film any of those strikes. We read a lot about them. We supported them. We stood in solidarity. And that summer, we were talking and we said, we wish somebody had filmed. You know, we wish somebody had been in that room, in that classroom, in that lunchroom, wherever the conversation was happening, to see, you know, these teachers, ordinary teachers around these states, stand up and fight back, and bus drivers and school nurses, not just teachers. And then we said, okay, well, we missed that one, but there's got to be more, right? And we looked around, and a friend of mine who teaches in LA, you know, said they're negotiating a contract. Their superintendent had been intransigent, and they really felt like they were preparing for a strike. And we went and we started filming. The first day of filming was the day they counted the strike authorization vote in LA. 98% voted yes to authorize a strike. And so we said, all right, this is, you know, they're not following necessarily in the footsteps, since it's all happening in tandem in these waves. They, along with CTU, teachers in Chicago and around the country, had been organizing, and they pulled it off. And that's what we hope to try to document in this film, how they did it, why they did it.
No, it was an exciting period, but a desperate period, because, you know, we had had teachers on from all of those places. You know, I had done hundreds of interviews of teachers and students. And one teacher stuck out in my mind from Oklahoma. She said to me that, you know, and again, you know, we get caught up on reasons why people went on strike, and everyone goes, oh, it's about the money, it's about the pay and the benefits. For this woman, this blew my mind. It was for feet on chairs. She said, you know, imagine having a classroom full of 40 kids and them only having 3 feet on a chair, and the distraction that is in the classroom. And our school district is so poor that we couldn't afford to make sure that every chair in the school had feet on it. I mean, that for me was just, it's a little thing, but it's kind of a big thing.
Totally. I mean, yeah, if you picture yourself in a classroom as a kid, you know, on a stool with three feet, I mean, and that's the kind of thing you hear around the country. In LA, you know, two of the biggest demands they were fighting for were smaller class sizes. There were students, we talked to a student who was in a AP chemistry class with over 50 students in the class. How you're expected to learn with over 50 students in a class, how a teacher is expected to address anybody's questions. You know, it's teaching, you know, in that situation, I just don't understand. That and a nurse in every school 5 days a week, which they're still, you know, is still a struggle to find, because they actually, this last contract fight that Los Angeles educators just went through, they convinced the district to recognize the fact that they need more nurses in schools, and that means that they need to raise the wage, because they're competing with salaries that nurses can make in other jobs. But if we want our kids, we talk to kids who, you know, dislocated a shoulder or broken a bone, you know, and if there's no nurse there that day, there's nobody to take care of you, and no parent wants their kid, you know, to be at a school without a nurse there that day. So these are basic demands.
There's a simple solution, Yanni. Just don't get sick or hurt on the day when the nurse isn't there.
Exactly. Yes. that's what we were telling those kids too.
The name LaPortia Mastery, you know, sticks in my head because this was a little girl in Philadelphia who died at school. And there was nobody there to give her a chance. And I'm not saying a nurse would have saved LaPortia Massey, but I'm saying that having a nurse there, a trained person there, would have given her a chance. And for me, that should be a minimum that's in our school system. That should not be a luxury only for wealthier districts, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, this last in 2023, earlier this year, Los Angeles teachers were negotiating a new contract. And, you know, Cecily Meyer-Cruz, the president of UTLA, she's the first woman of color to lead that union. Obviously, you know, teaching is a vastly, you know, majority women and women identifying job. And she's leading this union. And they had to fight, as she puts it, for the bare minimum, for lead-free water in their schools. I mean, this is really, teachers are fighting just to make schools safe for kids, in addition to fighting for, you know, ethnic studies and enriching curriculums, fighting to defend free speech and the ability to teach accurate history, again, as Randy was just talking about. I mean, they're fighting from the most basic to the most kind of, you know, we need to fight more for the dreams that we have, that our society has, if we want to, you know, to give every student and to protect our democracy.
What's interesting to me is, you know, in your film, the superintendent says, you know, who's going to pay for all this stuff? And my mind goes to the statement that I've heard a number of times, that we're the wealthiest nation in the history of civilization at its wealthiest moment. If we can't find the resources to prioritize our children's education and opportunities for the future, what does that say about us?
Yeah, 100%. And California is the richest state in the country. I mean, it would be one of the richest countries in the world if it was its own country. We're really, really talking about inequality. I mean, that's it. And raising taxes, you know, on the wealthiest. And the district has been sitting on a large reserve. You know, their argument is that they need to save that for a rainy day. And educators are saying, well, now is the rainy day.
It's pouring.
I mean, now is the time. Yeah. And we need to use that money and show that public education works, so we then raise taxes and get more money. And it just goes to show that really the main driver for this is you know, obviously we need to work with elected officials. We need to work through all channels. But the main driver of this is going to be organized labor. It's going to be teachers themselves working with students and parents who are going to be the ones who are going to make this cultural shift happen.
No, and this is the reason I'm such a supporter of organized labor. And the reason that, you know, a lot of my right-wing friends are anti-labor is because once you empower people in the workplace, once you give them the sense that they can make change in the workplace, they generally want to take that into the greater society as a whole. And our corporate overlords can't have that, which is why, again, the corporate attack on organized labor has been so strong over the years. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Yanni Govilov. He is a filmmaker. The film When We Fight, we'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. WhenWeFightMovie.com is the site, so you can see the trailer there. On the wider distribution, how can we see this movie? How can people get to see it, show it, bring it to their union halls, bring it to their churches? How can they do something like that?
Absolutely. And, you know, we'd love, people have been doing this around the country, actually, and around the world. In Montreal a couple months ago, a union there showed the film 40 times in anticipation of a strike vote that they were going to take. And we definitely don't take credit for the results of that strike vote. That was all their organizing. It was over 90%. But they showed the film at 40 of their different schools to prepare their teachers, because the film is, you know, meant to convey what it means to do this and to hopefully inspire and show that any, you know, you can do this. People around the country can do this. So if you want to show the film, anybody can contact us either via our website, WhenWeFightFilm or WhenWeFightMovie.com. WhenWeFightMovie.com, contact us there. There's a form and we'll talk to you and make sure that you have the files you need to screen the film with your school, your union, your classroom. And we're very excited that we've recently joined a filmmaker-owned, worker-owned cooperative, New Day Films, originally founded by feminist filmmakers who the mainstream distributors, surprise, didn't want to distribute their films. So they founded this company in the 70s, and now it's one of the leading distributors for documentaries in the educational field, New Day Films. So you can check us out there or on our website.
No, good stuff. Now, you were nice enough to send me a link, and I got to see the movie, and I think it's fantastic because it walks you through what the organizing that happened, as you said, the authorization vote, and then the work that went into it. And one of the lines that was in the film that grabbed my attention is, I hope people don't think striking is fun. She said, striking is exhausting. And as someone who has been on strike over my working career, I can attest to that, because the uncertainty of what you're doing, the loss, economic loss, the constant battle, this isn't something people take on lightly. This is the last arrow in the quiver, as I always say. But sometimes you're pushed into it and sometimes you have to. And I think you guys captured that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad. I mean, that was, you know, 5 a.m, you know, again, Cecily Meyer Cruz, she was a vice president of the union at the time, one of the vice presidents, she's now president. You know, we showed up at her house to go with her to a middle school that she was going to go picket at. And, you know, I mean, you can hear it in her voice. She doesn't have a voice anymore. I mean, these teachers were picketing in the rain. This is Los Angeles. It doesn't rain in Los Angeles very often. The very first day of the strike, it was pouring rain, as you can see behind me in this still from the film, multiple days of rain. And they miss their students. They're not getting paid. It's physically, mentally, spiritually exhausting. But what it also does is as you were just saying, it changes you. It changes your relationship to your coworkers, your relationship to yourself, your relationship to your students and to society. And we need that.
No, absolutely. In fact, the most important line, I think, of the film was one of the women stood up and said, you know, we've got to withhold our most valuable resource. I don't think she used resource, but you know, we got to withhold our labor. That's what we have. And as a member of the working class and a supporter of working class values, understanding that very concept is really important. And to have an educator go, you know, I get it. And then sharing that, I think, is really important.
Yeah, it was really it was an honor to get to film with these teachers. They were incredible. When we've screened the film at festivals, people have asked, you know, how did you, was everybody so eloquent? And the answer is yes. All of these teachers and their students and the parents who were involved, everybody knew what they were fighting for and was so, so eloquent about explaining it. Why they were fighting for it and what it meant. And that's our hope, that when people watch the film, they can see a bit of that, you know, this movement largely led by women that was, you know, transformative for Los Angeles, not only in 2019, but continues to reverberate today in Los Angeles and around the country and around the world. in this hot labor summer that will hopefully continue into the winter and beyond.
Well, I mean, all of that, we talk about, this expansion of union activity. It has been building for the last 10, 15 years as, you go through, Occupy Wall Street, you go through, the Red for Ed movement, you go through all of these organizing campaigns that teach people how to be part of this, teach people how to be active, engaged, empowered. And it's leading us to this and hopefully better days into the future. But it's films like yours I hope people will take a look at to get a little baseline of what it takes and how it happens. So last question I've got for you. What kind of responses are you getting? I know there's some critical acclaim. What kind of responses are you getting from folks?
Yeah, it's been incredible. It's hard to describe. We got to premiere the film last year at the Labor Notes Conference with teachers from Los Angeles and, people who organize at their workplaces from around the country. And then at the March on Washington Film Festival, honoring the March on Washington, which was also a march for jobs and freedom and against inequality and poverty. And we won a prize there last year at the festival, and we've just been excited that the film it's played in as far away as Japan and where did it just play in Norway? In Sweden, where teachers there are fighting a voucher system. It's just been one of the most beautiful things to see people see themselves and their own struggles reflected in the film and the possibilities. So we're ecstatic.
Excellent stuff. You did a great job. I'd love to see some of the stuff that didn't make it into the film. I'm sure there was a lot. WhenWeFightMovie.com is the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. And Liani, I hope you'll come back. I would love to do some kind of an event down the road where we hook up and we show this to folks. We got to work on that.
I'd love that. And I'd love to hear about when you were on strike. So definitely I'd love to get, do this again.
Thanks so much, Yanni. I appreciate it. Again, the website, whenwefightmovie.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Think Tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. That was the day that one of the most pitched battles in U.S. labor history, the Battle of Blair Mountain, began in West Virginia. Coal fueled the engines of industry, keeping the trains moving and the steel mills humming. Labor organizing in the coal fields faced violent repression. The conflict turned bloody at Mattawan. Friend of labor, local lawman Sid Hatfield, had won a gun battle against armed members of the notorious Baldwin Felts Detective Agency. Then, other Baldwin Felts agents, brought to West Virginia by the mine owners, gunned down Hatfield in cold blood. The miners' anger boiled over. 600 miners gathered under the United Mine Workers of America District 17 banner. The armed miners were determined to march into the state's southern coal fields. Their aim was to promote the union effort and sweep away the gunmen hired by the mining companies. As they marched, more and more miners joined them. As many as 10,000 miners converged on Blair Mountain. The high ground stood between the unionized northern part of the state and the less organized southern mines. At Blair Mountain, they met Logan County Sheriff Don Chafin, who had amassed an army of 3,000 armed men to repel the miners. Chafin's men had dug trenches, blocked roads, and marshaled machine guns to stop the Union men. In the battle that ensued, 1 million rounds were fired. The mine owners hired private planes to drop shrapnel bombs on the miners. The United States Army finally arrived. The miners, many of them World War I veterans, surrendered. Although the owners had won, what occurred at Blair Mountain drew national attention to the unsafe working conditions and the brutality of the coal barons in the coal fields.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
ericsmithshow.com. Interesting story coming out of Georgia. Rudy Giuliani evidently has lost a defamation suit. Actually, this was kind of like by default. He didn't even really defend himself. Now, you may remember the names Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss. They sued Rudy over the claims that he made that they, that they rigged the election. And, you know, look, this is part of when you defame someone, when you lie about them, they can sue you. So these two election workers, that's what they did. And they've won. In fact, I believe they won something like, what was it, like $250,000 or something like that. And which clearly Rudy, I don't think has the ability to pay, or so he says. But what's interesting is he chose not to go through the discovery process and give information that was being sought. Now you could go, well, that was because he didn't want to get his, you know what, in a ringer. because had he put forth the information that they're asking for, it probably could be used against him in a different court setting. One that, I don't know, could see him going to jail for a very, very long time. So was it a smart thing to do to pay the defamation? Because it's actually $90,000 and $43,000 in legal fees. Was it smart? We'll see. Also today, the big news, Donald Trump told Glenn Beck that he's going to lock people up. He's going to go after his political opponents because they're doing it to me. What I find interesting about Beck, though, is Beck has reframed the Hillary thing. And this is the right wing trying to rewrite history, a major rewrite. Remember, he in 2016, he ran on lock her up and there were chants and the red hats were going crazy. We're going to lock her up. Beck says, you said in 2016, lock her up. Why didn't you, basically? And you said, we don't do that in America. It's not the right thing. That's what they're doing, Beck continued. He goes, do you regret not locking her up? And if you're president again, will you lock people up? And he's like, well, yeah, of course I'm going to, because they're doing it to me. Now, this is, like I said, this is an example of rewriting history. Had there been a reason to lock her up, there's no question that the Trump DOJ would have done it. There just wasn't anything to lock her up over. Trump's response was, well, I'll give you an example. The answer is you have no choice because they're doing it to us. And he said that he never hit Biden as hard as he could have. I don't know what that means. He said, I've always had such great respect for the office of the president and the presidency. And then I heard he was trying to indict me. Biden wasn't the guy. I know Jesse Waters and the F Channel are saying, Biden's running all this from the Oval Office. He's got other things to do, like make work pay again. I don't know if you've noticed, been really busy getting actual work done. And what I find ironic is I don't think Joe Biden thinks much about Trump at all. I think Biden spends a lot of time between Trump's ears, but I don't know. I'm just not saying it. So we will see. We will see what hit hard means coming up. Also, there's going to be the second Republican debate. That's going to happen on September 27th at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. And it will be moderated by Stuart Varney and Dana Cappuccino Perino. This ought to be what was that thing that Trump said? S show? Yeah, this should be that kind of a show. With these two moderating the debate. I can't wait to see how off the rails they go here. Now, Trump's not going to show up. He would be stupid if he did. Politically, why would you? Why would you engage with the children who are just looking for attention? Look, if I'm advising Trump, I say you don't do it, and he's not going to. There's one thing, he's politically savvy enough not to walk into that. Evidently, Tucker Carlson thinks Democrats are going to assassinate Donald Trump. And now this is one of those things. I love the quote. He says, if you begin with criticism, then you go to protest, then you go to impeachment, and now you go to indictment, and none of them work. What's next? I mean, you know, graph it out, man. We're speeding toward assassination. Obviously, he says, and no one will say that. Really? See, this is one of those weird moments where, again, you know, as I've said before, there are people who, when they're thinking things, they project it onto others. You know, my mother always said, if someone's accusing you of doing something, it's probably because they're doing it. This is one of those weird kind of moments where when I first read the story, I'm going, no, Tucker, that's not this side of the aisle. That's your side of the aisle. That's the crazy side. How about we don't talk about this? How about we...
You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.